Hi, I'm Zohara with The Soloist. Conversations on soul, music, education, life, and many things in between. The places we meet in soul. Welcome to the Soloist podcast. And today I'm in conversation with Lane Arie. Let me tell you a little bit about Lane. Lane is a senior process work trainer and the founding faculty member of the Process Work Institute in the USA. Whether teaching, working in private practice, facilitating community and organizational conflicts, or learning and training alongside social justice groups, Lane partners with people to help create more inner and outer freedom and wholeness. He helps people transform their music, creativity, and stage fright, and is the author of Unintentional Music, Releasing Your Deepest Creativity. Lane co-led a six-year UN-funded project in the Balkans that brought together Serbs, Croats, and Muslims after the war to work on ethnic tension, post-war trauma, and building sustainable community. He has facilitated conflicts between Aboriginal Australians and European Australians, and between Dalits, so-called untouchables, and high-caste Hindus in India. Lane is a facilitator and trainer for Racial Justice Collaborative and is the author of The Vicious Cycle of White Centrality in Dr. Kenneth V. Hardy's The Enduring, Invisible, and Ubiquitous Centrality of Whiteness. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, USA, and loves to hang out with his wife and kids, play music, meditate, and follow the mystery. Welcome, Lane.
Thank you, Zohara. No, so nice to see you again.
So nice to see you again. So in the pre-chat, we just realized that it's been 20 years since the time we met. And it doesn't feel like 20 years.
Not at all.
It is this kind of relationship that we can continue from the place that we stopped. So Lane, just before you start, tell us about your weather. Like, where are you? What's the weather outside? And then tell us a little bit where, just that we know how to connect where you are now.
Okay. Well, I'm north of San Francisco in California. And today is actually sunny day, which is lovely. It has been pouring rain with very high winds for a couple of weeks. We had 100-mile-an-hour wind here recently. We need the rain because where I live, there is lots of drought a lot. So we need the rain, but maybe not all at once.
Okay. It just helps me to feel the person according to the weather. Do you also feel that weather has got a big impact on where we are every day?
Yes.
And I'm in a very hot, summery, tropical Queensland. And it's so hot. This is why you see the wind on my face. I need to sit with them. So where shall we start, Lane?
That's up to you.
I was really... Maybe we each a few words, if you feel like telling or talking about process work, because you definitely know, and I know a little bit of process work, been in a few workshops, but I'd like, maybe some people don't know what process work is. So just as much as you want to talk about what process work is.
It's a great place to start. So process work was developed by Arnold Mindell. and his wife Amy Mindell. And Arnie was originally a Jungian analyst and a trainer at the Jung Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. And so process work developed out of Jungian psychology. And yeah, there's a couple of things that came from Jungian psychology that are important to process work. The whole idea of the importance of dreams, and Jung said that dreams don't just happen at night, we're always dreaming. And process work really takes that and runs with it, takes that idea and runs with it. And how do we find our dreams in the tone of our voice, in our music, in the movements that we make, in the structure of the sentences that we use as we're speaking with one another, in the ways that we relate to each other in the world? We're looking out in the world and we're seeing all of these, in the moment, horrific things that are happening in the world. And how do we see that as dreams also? And so, you know, if I'm having a dream and then I wake up from the dream and then I'm thinking, oh, all of those things are in my dream, that's not me. But actually, it was my head on the pillow. So when I'm looking at the news and I'm thinking, oh, that's not me. But maybe that is also me. So the things that are not me in process work, we realize are also somehow part of us. And so how do we learn from that? How do we grow? How do we find more and more of our wholeness by realizing, oh, that's also me. Oh, how do I find out about that in myself? And then that can help us to grow as individuals. It can help us to get along better in relationship. It can help us to deal with the world and difficulties in the world and beauty in the world. That's a little taste of it.
So it's instead of saying, ah, it's just a dream, to say, wow, it's a dream. So,
Yeah.
okay.
And
And
let me just say, and
yeah, sure.
one of the big things that Arnie often told me when I was studying with him for years, was the question, how is the dream happening in the moment? In other words, if there's a dream or a background pattern that is organizing what's happening, how do we notice that in the moment? And so that for me is kind of a guiding question for me in my work and in my life.
And I'm living in Australia, which is a dream time of the Aboriginal people. So yeah, fascinating. And thank you, Elaine. And I think I met you in one of the World Work conventions. Which would you like to say a word or two or more about World Work of process work?
Yeah, so process work works with individuals, it works with relationships, it works with groups, it works with people, physical symptoms, working with coma and near-death situations, all kinds of experience, organizational conflict, community conflict, all kinds of things. And world work is the aspect that is working with so world issues and conflicts and nationalism and war and oppression and privilege and all of those things. So we met at a World Work conference in Sydney. So I think there were maybe 300 people there or something from 50 different countries or something like that. And so we were working on all kinds of of difficult things in the world from that, and learning how to process those conflicts and how to get along with each other better, how to conflict better rather than turning our back on conflict. How do we learn from it?
So, Lane, is it that when a conflict happens in the one place in the world, which does not you're not connected to, is actually the conflict is conflict? And if you are working on a conflict which doesn't belong to you, so to speak, in inverted comma, you're actually working on the conflict which happens in your country, in yourself. It's like the world, the soul of the world is our soul, is this connectedness that it's based on.
Absolutely. And it's not just a thought. It's not just an idea of that. It's an experience of that. So for instance, for 6 years, I worked with my colleague Arlene Odergom in Croatia, and also sometimes we worked in Kosovo. And with her husband Jean-Claude Odergon, who no longer is with us, sadly. We worked in Macedonia, but I'm remembering, for instance, that the 6 years in Croatia, working with Serbs and Croats and Bosniaks, Muslims, after the war in the Balkans, right? And there was all that ethnic cleansing there and all of that. And there were things there that I, there were things that happened there that also happen around my kitchen table. So for instance, this idea, you did this to me. Well, really? Well, you did that to me. And the intensity of that, we look over there and we think, those people over there, there's something wrong with them. They must just be violent. They must just be primitive, right? There's all these ways that we project all of our stuff onto them. But then when we actually notice, how are we in our own lives? How much of that is also something that we individually do in our own lives? And so, for instance, I remember I was sitting with this group of, there were maybe 60 people from different parts of Croatia and Serbs and Croats and Muslims and people from Serbia, people from Bosnia. And it was very tense. It was very tense, but we were trying to work through all of these tensions. And at some point, we got to a spot where it felt like people wanted to connect more. But one woman said, I feel like I'm with my husband lying in bed, and I want to reach across the bed, and I know my husband wants to reach his hand out to me, but no one dares to be the first one to reach across the bed. And that is just so human. And so to think that that's just them creates more conflict and more polarization because they're the problem. And that's the same in each country, right? In the United States, there's so much polarization right now, and each side says the other one is the problem. And I'm part of that too. I have my own point of view of what I think is right and what the problem is. And so I have that also. But how can I also sometimes remember, oh, how is that also me?
I don't know if I don't remember if I told you, but the way or the time I arrived to process work is the day after September 11. I was sitting in I lived in Sydney then. I was sitting for a coffee with a friend that was a process work psychologist, a very dear friend, Theo de Haas. And we talked about it and we cried together. And I said to him, I need to find the bin Laden in me. And he said, okay, process work. And I said, process what? He said, process work, go and search. So immediately I went home and I searched and I started making connection. And this is how actually I came to process work, to look for
Wow.
the bin Laden in me. And then realizing coming from a country which has gone through horrible thing, my first actually very deep process was about Aborigines and a white Australian. I think, I'm not sure if, no, I don't think it was in the same convention. And I took a very active part, thinking the whole time, what am I doing here? I don't even have to say, have a say. I'm not white Australian and I'm not even an Aborigine. But somehow throughout the process, I really became the white Australian. This was communicating with the Aborigines. And this is when I felt actually that it's the same. It's the same as you're saying. I could really feel it in my body. And I wanted to ask you, Lane, because many people do ask me, and I'm not enough process working in order to explain, or maybe I'm not explaining well enough. People ask me, so how is your work in like world work on a process that happens in Australia going to help the people in Australia? Not even people who live in another place. I mean, you are very privileged. You don't have to go through this war. So you can do the work and then have coffee and then come back and do the work. How is this going to actually help the people who are really suffering?
That's a very deep question. And I don't have the answer for that question. One answer is that it's not. Let's just start with that one. That I can do my work and that I'm privileged to have the time to do my work on myself and the right, the Aboriginal Australians who are being targeted by the police and who don't have food to eat and can't get work and whose land has been stripped from them. The work that I do on myself is not going to help those people. So that's one answer.
Very good one.
I think an important one. Another answer is that if I work on myself, or we work on that in a world work seminar or something like that, that there can be some kind of non-local effects. I don't know if that is actually true, but there's an idea in physics of, there's one particle that's spinning this way and its twin particle is spinning the other way, and when one changes, then the other changes. So who knows if that is true, if enough people work on themselves and work on that polarization, that who knows, maybe somehow could have an effect at least on the. So that's another possibility. I don't know if that is true or not. I have no idea if that is true or not. That's it's another thought. And another thought is that I do a lot of work on race and racism. So that's similar to the, European, Australian, Aboriginal Australian, Indigenous Australian, conflict and oppression and stuff like that. So the other thing is, part in my view, that oppression is systemic, right? That there are actual real things in the world. There's ways that people are treated differently, and some people get advantaged by the system, and some people get disadvantaged by the system. And those things play out on a systemic level, on an organizational level, on a material level. And then there's also ways that we are socialized to think about one another, right? That in the United States, I'm socialized. All the beautiful people on the beautiful people list are white. And all the politicians who are in power mostly are white, and most of the people on the most powerful, richest list are white. And so we're socialized to think, oh, those are the people who can be successful, right? And then, oh, and those people over there, they don't really have much, and they're not doing well in school, and they're not, so we're socialized to think, and then we see on the news that those are the ones that are shown on the news that are getting caught by the police and put in jail. Actually, much more white people get caught by the police and get put in jail, but those aren't the ones who make it onto the news. So these are systemic ways that then turn into ways that we are socialized to think and feel. So I was socialized to feel that Black people are not quite as smart as us and don't really work that hard because they don't have what my family has. But my family had all kinds of advantages, and I could go through them. My father worked in the my father was Jewish, right? So we always thought about, oh yes, we were oppressed, but we never I and my father worked hard. I always heard my father worked hard, and that's why he succeeded. He worked hard and he was smart. Now that meant that those other people who didn't succeed must not be hard workers and they must not be smart. That was the corollary message in that. But actually, my father went and fought in World War II, and then he got, this may not be very relevant to your Australian audience, but because he fought in World War II, he was able to go to college for free and go to law school for free. Black people who fought in World War II were not able to do that. My father, because he was white, was able to get a loan to buy his first house from the federal government. He got a loan. Black people did not have access to that loan. My father bought a house in a suburb that was redlined. In other words, only white people were allowed to buy houses there. People of color had to stay in more ghetto areas. So my father bought a house with the money that he got being a lawyer, with the education that he got from the government. And that house increased in value. When he died, that house, my brothers and I inherited it, right? So these are systemic things that benefit me and disadvantage people of color. But then, anyway, so let me just finish my thought. I went off onto a tangent there. I'm sorry. I went off
Oh,
onto
that's
a tangent.
okay.
So what happens then is that then those thoughts and those feelings are inside of me. I don't really think I'm better, but I feel a little bit that I'm better or they're not as good. And I feel a little bit scared of them because I see them on the news as being dangerous. And then when I'm in interaction with Black people, let's say, that starts to leak out in very subtle ways. And that's called microaggressions. And so if I work on myself and I learn about that and I see that is going on, then I can also change the way that I'm interacting. Because if I'm work, if I'm treating people from this superior way and committing these microaggressions, say in my workplace, I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about that. But not only am I doing, I get to do my job and just my job, but that Black person has to do his job or her job and also deal with my microaggressions. So that's another, it's like it's a second tax on them that I don't have. So that then contributes to the systemic problem. So it's like a vicious cycle.
It's interesting. I mean, and I love the thread of thought where it went. And what you said, it's not just, I mean, I don't have an Australian audience. I've got a world audience because this is the wonderful side of having a podcast. It just goes around the world and whoever can speak English. It's interesting because the question was, how is what people ask me, how is the work that you do here is going to help the people who go through the war? And you said, I love what you said. One of the answers you gave is it might not help. And I felt that I can breathe into this. And then another question came into the head asked by these people, presumably. So why do you do it? Why do you do it if it's not helping? And my answer to them was, that's the best thing I can do right now. I don't have another thing to do. It may put me in ease for a little while until the next minute. And then it's interesting how actually where the question took you to. And I want to ask you something which really triggered me. You said, so in a way, I don't have to worry about it because I'm privileged, or you didn't say privileged, but I'm saying it. Question. Is it really true? I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about me as well. I mean, the fact that I'm a privileged white woman, Jewish, educated, and so on, and well off, and whatever, well off comparing to people who don't have what to eat, saying my gratitude every day. Do I really don't have to worry? That's not my real truth. The truth is that when I wake up in the morning, I have lots of things that eat me from within. So is it like that it's the facade, I don't have to worry, but actually I have lots of inadequacy in me and lots of self-hatred in me. So it doesn't meet me in the right place, actually.
I agree. It's not that I don't have to worry. I don't have to worry about racism in my workplace. I don't have to worry about being pulled over by the police and having a gun pulled on me. I don't have to worry about my house that I'm trying to sell not being sold for as much because the person who assessed it saw it was a black people lived there, so it get it so it's a lower value. So I don't have to worry about those. I have to worry about all the same stuff going on in me. But black people have to worry about all that also, and on top of that, they have to worry about all of the different harms of racism. So I don't have to worry about racism.
I understand. I understand. Thank you for clarifying. So maybe that's a wonderful time to jump into the racism thing. I mean, I know that you told me that just before we started recording, that you are very moved by and moved with the work on race and racism. So I understand that this is something which is very, a topic which is very close to your heart. Would you like to tell about what you do about this work?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm really lucky. I have some great teachers about that. I'm studying now for the last 7 years with Kenneth V. Hardy, who's an amazing author and teacher and trainer and consultant. Yeah, so I'm learning a lot. I'm learning about how these how the system and how the socialization has seeped inside of me and how it leaks out of me without me knowing it. And so I'm learning to see that whole cycle. I wrote a chapter about that for Ken Hardy's book, and the chapter is called The Vicious Cycle. It's in your show notes. But so that's one thing that I can do. That I do is I write about it, I learn about it, I learn to see it more, and I learn to feel it. Ken Hardy talks about you have to see, you have to know about the seeing of all of those things and then the being of it. How does that live inside of me? And how can I notice that when it's coming up in me? And it doesn't just come up when I'm with people of color. If I'm in an all-white space, how do I notice? Oh, racism is happening here because this is an all-white space. Why is this organization that I'm in an all-white space? What an interesting question. That is racism. It's not just they bring race.
Yeah.
Race is something that white people have imposed. So noticing that, being with that, so for me, for instance, a huge thing for me is I feel that this work has, and let me just say, and then after you see what's happening and you be with what's happening, you allow it to impact you, then you can do something about it. If you don't, if you start with, oh, let's do something about racism, before you've seen and been with it, then Ken Hardy says it's like shooting in the dark because you can just replicate the problem as you're trying to do something about it. So, anyway, that's an answer, I guess.
And maybe it's also time to touch now about the other thing that we mentioned about your, I'm holding your book here, the unintentional music, releasing your deepest creativity, which I read many years ago, I confess, and I would like to reread it. Please tell us a little bit. I mean, what make you write this book? By the way,
So,
it's a fascinating book. I didn't say it. So I just love this book. You can see, by the
thank
way,
you.
I've got all these scribbles and highlights and everything. It's a very, very beloved book.
Thank you, Zahara. I am a musician. I've been a singer and a guitar player and songwriter for many years. Then I started to study process work. And when I started to study process work, my teachers said, well, bring your music into this and bring process work into your music. So I started to, okay, so how do I see those things? And how can this be used with music? And so I started to experiment and to have ideas. There's an idea in process work that there's a part of us that we know and that we're intending to do and that we're aware of. That's more who we think we are. And then there's another part of us that we don't know so well, that it happens unintentionally. It just comes out. And that we think that's not me, right? Like, oh yeah, those people at war, that's not me. That we're not that aware of. And so the same thing happens when we're playing music. Of course, there's some part of us we intend for it to be a certain way. I want my voice to be rich and full and open, and it starts to be like this or something like that, or I hit the wrong note, or my fingers go to the wrong place on the guitar, or I go too fast, or I go too slow, or whatever it is. And so process work would say, and so this idea that I had about unintentional music says maybe that is a different part of me that's trying to express itself. And if I only try to repress that and put it down, that's its own kind of oppression, right? It's a kind of inner oppression. And yes, it's great. It's fantastic. We need also what we intend. There's a chapter in my book also about the beauty of the intentional in music and in creativity, but also sometimes come out, let's explore what is trying to come out. And so, yeah, there's lots of different ways of doing that. Yeah.
I love the topic. Would you mind if we talk a bit more about this topic? I could see
I
that my
love talking
energy is
about it.
completely changing. We talk about combination of process work and music. This is where I can breathe and swim and ask all the questions which make me very, very interested in. So is it okay?
I'm sorry I got so heavy with the other part there, but anyway,
No.
yes, it's very good for me too.
We just find our own niche, and especially in the places which we don't expect. I remember when I read it then, but as I said, I haven't read it for quite a few years now. But I remember then that one of the things which really drew my attention was that this is for every musician, classical musician, jazz musician, musicians who improvise. And as much as I remember, and that was the way that I always wanted to look at music, it's not that we are the unintentional music. There will be a question mark at the end, by the way. The unintentional music is not to change, like this is not wrong note, make the wrong note right. It's the way we play the music or the way we express the music. We're not going to change Beethoven Moonlight Sonata and say this is not the wrong note, this should be here. It's just what happens, as you say, the thing is a secondary process, what's happening in us, and we can use it as a vehicle to explore more about our own inner process. Is this sort of the right way to understand it?
It's about our, yes, absolutely. It's about our own inner process, but also how that impacts how we play and how we sing. And sometimes, not for classical music, but it can actually change what we're playing. It can actually change the notes sometimes, or it can bring in. It's for composers, or for it's also not just about music. It's about writing and theater and art and all kinds of things. But yes, let's say I did a lot of work for years with the Conservatory of Music in Bern in Switzerland, and there it was mostly classical musicians who want to play, their pieces, but how to bring in also what's inside of them to have that, to be able to express themselves through the music. And unintentional music is really a beautiful vehicle for that. So for instance, I'm thinking about this pianist who I was working with, and she was playing this Brahms piece. And I noticed that as she was playing, she was the way she was moving her hands up and down, and she was moving her back. You can't see me in the podcast, but there was like a way, it was almost like a wave or something like that. And but she was totally unaware that she was doing that. It was unintentional. And so I brought her attention to that, and I asked her to do that more. And she started to do that more, and something really transformed. She was playing exactly the same notes in the same tempo and everything, but there was so much more feeling in it, and it was really moving to hear that Brahms then. Before, it was a little bit more mechanical. So that's an example, for instance.
I was what pulled my attention is when you said that some musician, when they play in a way, they say, but that's not me. And something comes out and this is not me. So I understand that's not the way I see myself, or that's not the way I want other people to see me. It's like I remember when I used to say things as a young child to my mother, she said, "Oh, it doesn't suit you to talk like this." And being the rebel that I was, I said, "Since when you know exactly who I am? There are many sides that I don't even know about them." And as I grew up, I was asking myself, is this what Jung called the shadow part? Because the shadow is not just dark and black and bad. It's the unseen part in us. So when you talk about unintentional music, Lane, do you mean these parts that actually we are not putting in the front, not wanting people to associate them with us? Is this what you meant as well?
Yes, first of all, I just have to say you were a born process worker. So yes, all of those things that we are not in touch with, we, as Walt Whitman said, we contain multitudes, but we're not aware of that. We only are aware of small parts of ourselves. And then there are some parts we are aware of, but we don't like them. So we would like to push them into the margins. And oh yeah, don't look at this. Don't look at this part of me. Like in The Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? We don't want to show that part of ourselves. And they can be parts of us that are difficult, that we don't like. They can also be parts of ourselves that we would love to have, but we don't feel like we can. I work, yeah, anyway, I work these days with a group in Ukraine. And that thing of like, anyway, let's not go there. Let's stay with the music part. But yes, there's it can be really beautiful things. It can be, I could never do that, is also a statement of like, there's a box around myself, and that box around me is populated by voices that said you shouldn't go outside of this box, but it's also you can't be like that, or you'll never be like that. And so yeah, there can be all kinds of beautiful things that are over our edges too.
You said, let's not go there, let's stay with the music. And I just want, there's a correction. Music is a vehicle for me. Music is not an aim or an end goal. One of the reasons I chose not to continue being a concert pianist is at some point it didn't really nurture my soul. I knew that in the soul work, this is when I'll find my solace. And you said about the good sides, like the good side of the hidden parts. I understand this is what Robert Johnson called the golden shadow, the thing that we want to be and we think we will never be. And I feel so. I would love, I invite you to go to this place that you said, let's not go there, because I felt that you're taking away from me something which might be very interesting to me and to the audience. Do you remember what it was when you said, let's not go there, let's go back to the music?
Well, I was thinking about the group that I work with in Ukraine, but I want to, it's a very fresh thing. There's war happening there right now, and for the last 2 years, almost exactly. And so I want to honor their process and not talk about the stuff that I'm talking about with them. So that's another reason I said, let's not go
Sure,
there.
sure. Maybe this is
But
why. There you go.
no, go on, go on.
Maybe that's what why I was actually drawn to this, because being coming was I was born in Israel, as you know, and what Israel is going through now, and I don't live in Israel for many, many years, almost 50 years, but it's still the country of my birth, and I will share my point of Ukraine when the war just started in Ukraine. I think it was just a few weeks after it started. I was invited to teach in Poland. And there were quite a few people that came to the workshop from Poland. They were refugees. And I felt such a connection with them, not talking the same language even, just because I felt that they're going through something that I remember as a child growing in Israel. And you said something which really touches my heart, and I will dare saying it now. I want to respect the place that they are. It's still happening there. So I suppose what I want to ask you, I'm not even sure what I want to ask you, but I'm taking the risk on air. When there is a very horrific war happening in a place, and as it reminds me of the question which I asked at the beginning, and when people think they are just in survival mode, all people who are exposed to the war, not just one side, all the sides, they are in horrific survival, existential situation. Is there anything that we can offer as people who don't live there? I mean, I'm not saying offer, like just from our heart. Is there anything that we can do? Because I remember reading, yeah, you go back, go home and do more inner work. You might help conflicts which happen in other places. What is your take on this, Lane? Because we live in a place which does so many wars.
Wow. That's such a big question, Zohara. I mean, one thing that I do is I when I can, I try to work with people there if I can. But that's not for everyone. I talk about it with my friends. I talk about my feelings about it, my pain about it, my grief about it, my fear about it. There are so many wars happening on the planet right now that don't get talked about. Yes, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, right? Those are the ones that get the headlines, but there are so many others. Yemen, South Sudan, so many, southern Thailand that don't get the headlines. So if I'm feeling about it, don't just feel about it myself, because it's not just me, it's us. And that again, that doesn't do anything for the people who are in those places, except just yes, I'll just say this one thing about Ukraine. Just yesterday, I was on Wednesday, I was working with this group in Ukraine, and this woman said, "I just want my pain to be heard. I just want my pain to be heard. Thank you, Lane, for listening." And I said, "Okay, I hear your pain, I feel your pain, and I will be your microphone." So I guess I'm doing that now into my microphone. So I guess she actually did ask me to say something. So the pain and the fear and the exhaustion right now in Ukraine, and that the United States is wondering whether it should give any money, and Russia has so many more people, in so many more soldiers, and so many more weapons, and Ukraine is very afraid right now. And it's totally exhausting to the people, and so much grief and so much fear. And so I guess, yeah, I have a microphone now to amplify her voice. That's something we can do.
I respect your answer and the place that you're talking from. Deeply respect it. Because, first of all, I respect, I don't have to find a reason for respecting it. I feel it very deep in my heart. And for a minute, I don't even know if you're, what am I talking about? It is the Ukrainian one, the Gaza-Israeli one, the Yemen one, the Thailand one. I just feel like a big cry wants to come out of my heart. And in a way, you know, Lane, in a way, I want to say two things about it. One is that I feel as if it's a where we went full circle because we came to the same place that I asked the question at the beginning of our conversation today. And also I would like to say, maybe they are connected, I feel. I don't get many chances of talking like this, definitely not on air, but I'm not on air most of my life. I'm just meeting people. I don't get a chance because I feel there is a, what is the word actually? Expectation. I'll say this for the lack of another word that I can find. There's expectation for me to be clear. Or people expect me to be clear, even if they know that I will not take a side, because I don't like taking one side. I will try to associate myself with this side, with the other side, and maybe we can find together a third way. But almost like there is expectation to behave, expectation to perform, to put a show in a way. And as I said, I've been through this quite a while, a lot. In the last 2 years since my husband died, because I felt that many people are expecting me to, okay, soldier on, enough, enough, now continue, not respecting where I was. And I understand maybe I was in the same place before I went through this big loss. So I hope I'm not judging. I want not to judge, but I found a very little opportunities to have this kind of discussion. You said, I'm talking with my friends. I'm not just staying with this alone. And I know that we are not alone. As you and I are talking now, there are many people who listen and feel, oh yeah, this is what I'm looking for, because I get it from the email that I'm getting from listeners. Is there any way, Lane, that you can actually share how people can find these places to have a voice?
Well, first of all, I want to ask you something. Sorry, I know you're the interviewer.
No,
May I
please.
ask you something?
Sure.
The expectation to perform what? What do you feel the expectation is?
That's a good question, the expectation. Okay. The expectation to come back to the way I used to be before my beloved died. So, I mean, everybody has got their own list of who they see Zohara is. The pianist, the teacher, the lecturer, the wise woman, da 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 da. So, okay, if not all of this, at least something. Just go back and perform it. And in the places which I'm grieving, was grieving, am grieving, will grieve, none of them exist. There's only the woman who grieves her husband death. So this is the
Yeah.
expectation. Yeah.
Yes. So may I frame something about what you're
Yeah,
saying?
yeah. Feel free. We are in conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I have to ask it, right?
Yes,
Consent is
thank
important.
you. Thank you
This
for
is an
asking.
intimate conversation, and with intimacy, consent is always needed. So I talked to a little bit ago about the box that is around us, and those and populating that box, on the walls of that box are all of those voices who keep us in the box. And also identities, the box, it keeps us in our known identities. And it says, don't go outside of those identities. So what you just said, the voices. Now, we don't know. Maybe some people actually say those things, but maybe it's also those voices are inside of your head and you think that's what they're saying. They respond in a certain way. They get uncomfortable. They get quiet. And you think, oh, they want me to be the teacher. They want me to be the wise woman. They want me to be the this. They want me to be the that. And so then you keep yourself inside that box. Even though you know you are so much bigger than that. And when you were 20, you were not yet the wise woman. When you were 30, you were not yet all of the things you are. Why at this age must you stop growing? And how much do you have to teach? How there is so much, I won't say that as a question, I want to say it as a statement. There is so much for you to teach, so much wisdom for you to share as the woman who is grieving. It makes me want to cry. I think about the grief in that group yesterday in Ukraine. I think about the grief in Gaza. I think about the grief in Israel. I think about the grief in Yemen. I think about the grief of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans people who will be sentenced to death in so many countries in Africa if they show who they are. The grief and the fear. And so I think if you don't grieve, that dishonors them. You showing your grief in this part of the world where, oh, you're not supposed to grieve. You're not supposed to be old. You're supposed to be young. You're supposed to be mindful. You're supposed to be wise, right? But grieving models something that has an impact. and maybe even going a little further than you're going to get even further outside of that box is to connect your grief in yourself and also when you're talking to your friends about it with the grief in the rest of the world. It's a thought.
Yeah. I received your blessings now. You gave me your blessings. Because as you started talking, I was thinking how much of as you were starting to describe the box, I was thinking, how much of this actually I'm putting myself in the box. I mean, immediately I went there. And I can see it, and I can see how uncomfortable it is for me to go out of these roles which I'm playing in society. I will be as honest as saying that even the grieving process and getting becoming an elder, an old woman, being an old woman and embracing it with all the difficulties, I also realized that I'm also going making a role out of this. Because I'm talking about how it is to be an old woman, how it is to be a widow, how it is to grieve. I'm also making, and this is not just bad or good, just I'm finding the good in this in order to be more of who I am. So whatever you said is giving me a permission to do more. N not to do more, that's not right. I'll say to continue doing it. I can say to myself, I think I've got Lane's blessing to continue doing this and not to find another way.
To open to it,
Open to, yeah.
to say, this is what's happening. The essence of process work is this is what's happening.
Oh, okay. As we are about to finish at some point, is there anything that you feel that you would like to talk about, or anything that you feel that I should have asked you and I have not asked you? About anything.
I'm just so moved by your honesty and vulnerability here in public, by your willingness to notice that you keep yourself in a box, and that you could also choose to be whatever is here. It really moves me, and I'm moved by somehow this strange this strange circuitous route that we have taken. And I appreciate your not being your I appreciate your openness to the different strange paths that I took as well. And I just hope your listeners stayed with us until we got to where we got to. It feels an important place where we got.
I will say thank you because I just realized that we are not going to put a video of this one, and I'm just nodding to you in gratitude. And it doesn't come across in an audio thing, so I'm saying a big thank you from the bottom of my heart to the way you allowed me, and maybe in some hidden way even guided it without trying to guide it, because we know it's a mutual thing. And as I said, this is one of the reasons, as I said at the beginning, Lane, that I never plan these conversations. I can find myself when I allow the flow to lead us. And if I need to guide it or control it, then I'm not enjoying it. And the truth is that I'm mainly doing this podcast for myself, very selfish. Just being sitting with a person like you and having all the gifts that you shared with me now,
Thank
I'm
you.
deeply grateful.
Thank you. Me too. Can I just say one last thing that is
Say
in my heart?
last and second last and third
Yeah.
last.
I'm just noticing how I, when we were talking about racism, and I was talking about my father and the systemic racism and stuff, I'm a little bit sad. I kind of went into one of my roles, which is, it's like that was kind of a set piece. And I'm a little disappointed in myself that I went into a set piece about that. I wasn't as fluid as I would hope to be. And yeah, anyway, I just wanted to say that, and I got a little bit on my soapbox, and I want to apologize to your listeners, and at the same time, like the microphone, like I wanted to be a microphone for that Ukrainian woman. I also feel it's important for people to hear, but the way that I did it was a bit stiff, which I don't always appreciate. I think the thing I want to say is what my work with race has done the most is open my heart to my own humanity and to the humanity of others. I think that's probably the most important.
It's so interesting because, first of all, thank you for saying it. And I think some words that we've been using for many years with good intentions, all of us as a society, race is one of them, white supremacy is another one. All these words that we're using, I think the words have become stiff. I'm not sure, I didn't feel it here as becoming stiff, but the word is stiffening something because when you say the word race, the system, which is Zohara, is just going, okay, race is this. And I become what usually Zohara becomes when there is a talk about race. So the words that we use are locking us in some form that doesn't
It's
serve us.
another box.
Yeah, it's another box. It's another box, exactly. And you were saying, I mean, I was saying at the beginning, introducing you, I was saying there was a phrase that drew my attention. Lane partners with people to help create more inner and outer freedom and wholeness. I love the word freedom. Oh, I love the word freedom. So I really just said, How does it happen?
Well, first of all, I mean, in that moment that I went into that little set piece about race, I wasn't in my inner freedom or wholeness. I was in my box. So it happens by noticing that.
Yeah.
Noticing it in myself, noticing it in others. The way that I noticed it in you. And then I feel like I partnered with you to support your freedom to be the whole of who you are and not to be this thing or that thing that you think that others need. Expect from you or want from you. So that was how is like a whole, there's a skill and an art and then everything, but that was an example of that.
Can I share with you something about this particular point, this bit? When you allowed my freedom, I felt seen, I felt heard, I felt relieved. And when you went into, when you explained the way that you were maybe being too stiff, so you were talking about yourself, discovery about yourself, I felt the same, but more. I felt so safe. And immediately it brought me to, if we just have more and more, you, I, all of us, and also the people who go through horrendous time now, realize that the person in front of them, the one that kills them, has got also this part in them. That changes everything, actually. And it's pretty rare.
It's hard to do that if somebody's in front of you trying to kill you.
That's true. Thank you.
But I love what you're saying at the same time.
So, Lane, anything which I should have asked you, or I should, anything that you would like to add before we say our goodbye?
I love being with you. Thank you.
So mutual. So the same. So what if 20 years have passed, just like yesterday? And I hope it won't take me another 20 years to get connected with you in these small worlds of us. Thank you, Lane, so much. All the things that all the information, and if you want me on more information to add, please send it to me. It will all be in the show notes of this episode. And I will say thank you from the bottom of my heart on behalf of myself and behalf of the listeners, as you said, managed to stay until the end. And thank you for now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sohaka.
Thank you for being with us. If you like to support this podcast, please subscribe to it, share it with friends, leave a comment and rating stars in Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcast. And you could always join our list to get notified when a new episode is on air. If you wish to support the podcast by donating, please click the PayPal link that you'll find in the show notes. And thank you for your generosity. You could also find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube channel, LinkedIn, and in my website. All of these appear in the show notes. Wishing you all the best. Lots of love.